My name is John McAuliffe, and I co-direct the Centre for New Writing with Ian Maguire. The Centre for New Writing is this university's home for the criticism and writing of new fiction and poetry. At the centre, we provide a link between writers, critics, and their audiences inside and outside the university. We run public events with our Professor of Creative Writing, Martin Amos, and also host a regular reading series called Literature Live. You will have found information about our future events on your seats, I think, including upcoming events with Colm Tobin and Andrew O'Hagan, and with Neil Gaiman, among others. I'd also like to tell you about our exciting new online arts journal, the Manchester Review, which went live yesterday, and which you can check out by typing in, and this is the long bit, www.themanchesterreview.co.uk in your computers. Because these titles are not easy to remember, you should all have a bag with the address printed on the side of it to take home with you. Now, however, I'm delighted to welcome our speakers. They are Martin Amos, author of some of the finest fiction and non-fiction of the past 40 years in books such as Money, The Information, The War Against Cliché, Experience, and most recently, The House of Meetings and The Second Plane. Martin is also, of course, Professor of Creative Writing here at the University. Alongside Martin is James Fenton, journalist, editor, librettist, and the English poet who has most obviously inherited the mantle of W.H. Auden, writing poems of great range and formal variety, most recently collected in a Penguin Selected Poems. The subjects of both his and Martin's work have been war, death, love, politics, but also comedy and satire. Some of these subjects, but certainly not all of them, they share with the poet we will be discussing tonight. The format of the event is that each of us will make short statements about Philip Larkin's work before discussing it more generally, and there will be time for questions from the floor at the end. I'm going to begin now by briefly reminding you of Philip Larkin's biography. Philip Larkin was born in 1922 in Coventry, and attended schools there before going up to Oxford in 1940. He escaped military service because of his poor eyesight and graduated with a first in 1943. He published two novels, Jill and A Girl in Winter, while working as a librarian in Shropshire and Leicester. In 1950, he moved to Belfast, and while in Belfast, began to write seriously as a poet. He moved to Hull in 1955, where he was university librarian until his death in 1985 at the young age of 63. In Hull, as well as developing and managing the university library, Larkin worked as the Guardian's poetry reviewer and then the Telegraph's jazz reviewer. He published the three books of poems which have made his reputation, The Less Deceived, The Whitsun Weddings, and High Windows, while also editing the Oxford Book of 20th Century Verse. The Less Deceived, in 1955, identified Larkin in the public eye with his friend Kingsley Amis and other writers who would become known as the Movement, a group whose poems are characterized by traditional forms, civility, and their rejection of the grander language of modernism. It was the Whitsun Weddings and High Windows, however, which established Larkin as the defining and most influential poetic voice of his time. In those books, lyrical poems move easily between the social and the personal, between history and the particular moment. Larkin, it must be said, has always been a divisive figure. His Oxford anthology saw Thomas Hardy and not W.B. Yeats as the great modern poet, and many reviewers have written him off as being too narrow, nostalgic, and middle-brow in style and subject. Others use the revelations about his personal life in his letters and the Andrew Motion biography to criticize the poems and the man. However, these revelations seem to have, if anything, increased Larkin's popularity in the 20 years since the publication of his collected poems. He was recently voted the most popular British writer since World War II in the Times and the nation's favorite poet in a Poetry Society poll. He's also become, I think, the defining English poet of the last half century, a byword for a certain idea of England, and possibly the only poet of that era whose work could be discussed in front of a crowd of nearly 600 people. I will hand over now first to Martin and then James, who I should say have spent the day experiencing and are now, I hope, recovered from the kind of delayed cross-England train journey so well known to Larkin's readers, coming up England by a different line, as Larkin put it.
Thank you, John. Can everyone hear me? And thank you all for coming on this vile night when you could be watching Sarah Palin and Joe Biden. I was talking to the poet Nick Laird, who said of his wife, Zadie Smith, her favorite poet is Larkin. And Nick said, but then again, all novelists love Larkin. And I thought about this, and it's true that Larkin was a poet in his early 20s. He wrote two novels, and then that dried up, and he became the poet of his generation. And many of his great successes in his longer poems, particularly, are novelistic. They're the great phrases that a novelist would be proud of, like Show Saturday, where he refers to cartooning curt-haired sons and middle-aged housewives glaring at jellies. The fathers in the Whitsun Weddings had never known success so huge and wholly farcical. These are the sort of nice observations and phrases that a novelist would be proud of. But I think novelists love him too because he is a character study. He's not like a poet like Eliot, who said, for instance, that poetry was not an impersonal, that's not quite the right word, but a disinterested use of words, that it was from a certain height, that it was that the ego had been kind of rubbed out of the poetry. You don't feel this with Larkin. It's an engagement with a personality, with a character, and with a basic problem. Now, I'm plenty interested in the poetry, but I'm going to talk about the man, the personality, for a bit because of my privileged access. I was a privileged observer in that he was my older brother's namesake and godfather. And he was much around when I was a child. Now we were told, Philip, my brother and I, were told that Philip, the poet, hated children, A, hated children, and B, was incredibly mean. So there was always this ritual when he came to stay where it was called tipping the boys, where he would, you know, as godfathers do, as my children were tipped last night by their godfather, in rather more generously than Larkin tipped us. My godfather was a marvelous sort of swaggering drunk, and he used to give us lots of money, my brother and me. He once gave us 10 bob on Guy Fawkes night. 10 bob, and it's like 50 quid now. But with Larkin, it was fourpence for Philip and threepence for me. And big, you know, those big black round pennies that weigh more than a pound coin does now, like 2 pound coins. And we used to be called in. We were very nervous because of this reputation that I now realize was cultivated by my parents, that they actually liked this spectacle of us coming in very nervously in and getting, and Larkin rather solemnly doling out, you know, maybe one at a time. It was realized later that we were kind of set up a bit. But, and I think Larkin did hate children, and you can see it in the sort of vibrant line where he says children with their shallow, violent eyes. But it has to be said that as a child, and I think a child is a very delicate recording instrument, as a child I felt nothing but benignity from him. I thought he had a very nice face and smile and never felt anything other than warm approval from him. That has to be said. Now I want to, that was the beginning when I was five, six. And I want to turn to, I think it was 1981, to not long before his death, when my brother and I, both grown men by then, had dinner with him and Monica Jones, his main girlfriend, at my parents' house in London. They just, now, at the time, I attended this dinner. It was a very pleasant, warm occasion. My brother, who's very undemonstrative, embraced Larkin, and Larkin reciprocated. He had a very warm, my father described it as a sort of sunny manner, socially, with people he sort of knew very well. And there was Monica, and we got through this evening, you know, pleasantly. And Monica was a bit of a problem, should we say. But I thought, this sort of old boot, eccentric old boot, I didn't think much of it. Thought she was a bit strange. They'd just been to see Pakistan play England cricket at Lord's, and Monica laying down the law about, no, that was Abdul Qadir, you know, not Imran Khan. I just thought eccentric, you know. But then, coming back to this memory after the letters, the collected poems, and the life, all which appeared in the early 90s, the memory became horrific to me. I'm trying to write about this in a sort of fictionalized way, but using the real character. And the horror of Monica, I don't say this lightly or callously, is something to be believed. Looking back in memory and seeing how parched his life was, how Monica was the main girl in his life, the love of his life. Now, she was a pretty young lady, as you can see from the photographs and the letters on the life. Re-examining this memory of this dinner, Monica looked like an urca. Now, you probably don't know what that means. This is the stratum of hereditary criminals that existed in Russia for centuries, since the time of Troubles. And she didn't look like a female urca, who were terrifying enough. You should read Yevgenia Ginsberg on what they looked like. She looked like a bloke urca. Very short hair, very mannish, big jaw, huge earrings. And I'm going to sort of be pedantic about this. She sort of dominated the evening. Kingsley and Larkin, sort of best friends, in as much as he had one. Larkin had one, but hadn't seen each other for years. But she dominated the evening and talked more than anyone else. And this is, I thought, the key to her. I was sitting next to her, and she made a funny noise when she wasn't speaking. It was a noise of satisfaction on the whole. And it was, and I thought, now what does this remind me of? This is a sort of little grunt of satisfaction every couple of seconds. And I remembered a friend who had a mad old relative, Auntie Jean, who had got it into her head that it was still July 27th, 1943. This was in the 70s. And they used to make sure that she never saw a daily paper, because she would freak out if she saw something that told her it was 1976. And then one day she did find such a paper and freaked out. And so they wearily got this sort of yellowing copy of the Times that had the July 30th, 1943, and gave it to her. And she made this noise when she had it on her lap. She went, and that was the noise that Monica made throughout dinner. Now, the conclusion with this double memory, a memory of not minding at the time, and then this horrific memory having absorbed just how central she was, and also the realization that people don't become eccentric and sort of boring and unbearable by themselves if they're in a long relationship. Someone has to let them do that. And Larkin clearly had just, you know, anything for a quiet life had let this happen. Now, since it turns out that Larkin's poetry, his poetic persona, is all about disappointment, is all about thwartedness in love, thwarted romanticism, the girls he never got, you know, the love, the capacity for love that was unused. And you know, it is the case that poets, he wrote a poem called Money, where he complains that he listens to his bank account, and quarterly is it, it reproaches me, I'm all you ever had of goods and sex. You could get them still by writing a few checks. And it ends in this strange stanza. I listen to Money singing. It's like looking down through long French, tall French windows at a provincial town. The church, the Guildhall, no, the canal, the Guildhall, the church, ornate and mad in the evening sun. It is intensely sad. It's all this sort of missing what he never had. He wrote a poem that was he suppressed called Letter to a Friend About Girls, which was addressed to my father. It's all about how the girls he met were put off men by being plain, religious, you know, frigid, etc. Whereas the Kingsley character, my father, it's sort of not him exactly, but seems to encounter a whole other grade of woman, where beauty is accepted slang for yes. And my father once wrote to him, he said, "It's I bloody give you up when it comes to women." He said, "It's not that I meet a different kind of woman. I just meet them differently." I asked my mother about this recently, and she said, well, he was, who admired and respected and sort of flirted with Larkin, said he had a stutter. But the truth is that the women love poets. I mean, they certainly loved them then, as I saw all around me that, you know, poets that looked like trogs had had five wives and 43 children and people attending to them. It wasn't to do with that. It was something to do, you know, the realist explanation is that it was just emotional sloth. Who was it who defined something as being too lazy to love? It was something like that. On the other hand, you could take the romantic view of this thwarted romanticism and say that he realized he was going to suffer terrible disappointment in love, which turns out to be the main thing in life. When you're dying, that's what you think about, not about your medals and your awards or anything like that. You think about the love life. So he was sort of doomed to disappointment about that, and he thought, I'll accept this, and I'll write the poetry that belongs to it. And he has done that inimitably and unforgettably.
Yeah, well, one of the things that I thought it might be worth saying in slightly in response to what John was saying at the beginning is, for me, looking back on the period in which I first started writing poetry and my friends at university were writing poetry, and we were all split along different lines and subscribed to different camps and so on. Larkin wasn't a figure that, as far as I recall, he wasn't a great figure for us. And there was not yet this split over him. Now, when I say that he wasn't yet a figure for us, of course, he hadn't yet produced the third of the major books, i.e. High Windows hadn't yet come out. And The Less Deceived, it's also worth remembering that The Less Deceived was published by a rather little-known press, and it wasn't necessarily widely available. It had been kept in print, and its publisher refused to let Fabers buy it up. So there was never a collected, I mean, for a long time, there was no collected Larkin. And so there was the volume, The Wits and Weddings, that you would know, you'd be most likely to know if you knew Larkin. Now, when I say we didn't divide over him, what I mean is that the major figures for us to go back to, or the point of departure for young writers was modernism, was Eliot and Pound. And I think the people I knew writing shared that generally. It was kind of accepted. You divided over where you went from there or who you added to that list. And in my case, the kind of people I was interested in reading when I was at university were mostly Americans, but apart from Auden. Auden was, to me, the big one. Auden wasn't, that wasn't a generally accepted opinion. A lot of people thought Auden had just betrayed modernism or betrayed his country and had gone downhill years and years ago. He was still alive, he was still writing, but a lot of people paid absolutely no attention to him at all. And they would go to one group, say, of American poets, like the Black Mountain poets or the protest poets, the beat poets, and define themselves in that kind of way. And I tended to go to what were considered East Coast American poets. It was people like Marianne Moore, Robert Lowell, Anthony Hecht. It was the early John Ashbery. There was a volume available, and just beginning to have a reputation, Elizabeth Bishop. But that was really a rare taste. But people would look at the people who took the rival point of view would look at a completely different list. But that's where we sort of divided. The other person who was somewhat absent from the scene as a sort of given figure, this is where Larkin does become controversial, but it's already mentioned, is Hardy. And Hardy was, in those days, I would say very much a poet's poet. Auden revered Hardy. Larkin revered Hardy. Larkin had revered Auden, but then he had rebelled against him. And because Auden's generation was in a kind of parental relationship with Larkin's generation, that was the sort of necessary murder that Larkin had to commit, that he had to get rid of Auden, because when he started out writing, he wrote like Auden, and he wrote like Yeats. So he had to get rid of both those influences before he could write like Larkin. And I think he did for Auden in his own mind in a very ungenerous way. He wrote an article called What Became of Whiston, which is still available, and it sums up a very prominent, a very common attitude of the time, which was that when Auden went to America, his talent went downhill. The first time I really came across Larkin's poetry as such, I remember very well, because it was at the New Statesman where I had just got my first job, and I was working as assistant literary editor. The literary editor came in one day, is Anthony Thwaite, who after Larkin's death, edited his collected poems. And he came in and showed me a poem, and he said, "This has just come in the post. Who do you think this is by?" And the poem was called Vers de Société. And I read it. I hadn't the foggiest clue who it was by. And when he said, "Surely you get it. It's unmistakable. It's Larkin." No, it wasn't unmistakable for me. And I wasn't even sure that I liked the poem. It's kind of become a part of our landscape since. And in a way, Larkin's fame, which has become such a feature of today. To me, it's a kind of posthumous fame. It did begin, I think, with the publication of High Windows. That was a book that was tremendously well received from a poet who was well known to write slowly and to produce very little, and here was his latest book, and it was both considered a milestone immediately, and I think has never been out of print ever since, of course. But it's at that stage, I think, we're talking about the mid-70s, that Larkin's great fame begins to take off, and then also you begin to get reprints of his fiction, which I think is very well worth reading, and they kind of enter into the mainstream of English literature. And I think I've seen in the last few years both a reputation grow and go through a rocky period, and somehow be reinforced after that rocky period by the continuing response of a general readership to Larkin's poetry.
Martin, I want to take you up on something about the women in Larkin's life, because his reputation and his persona, I suppose, about as being the bachelor hermit of Hull, who famously didn't want the bridge across the Humber because it would make the city less isolated, he managed to conduct these long affairs side by side right until 1978, when he finally moved in with Monica. And I was wondering, is that something that, this is a later Larkin, when he pretty much stopped writing, 77 was the last major poem, and Monica moved in 78.
You know? Yeah, well, that would have done it, I think. It's true that he did have 1.3 girlfriends simultaneously. Maeve Brennan, Monica, and
Betsy
Macareth, who was in the poem Toads, give me my intray, give me my loaf-haired secretary. She's the loaf-haired secretary. And she actually, while sort of yokelish in appearance, looked good fun. Yes. But I mean, having three girlfriends is no good if they're all no good. By this I mean that Larkin's girls weren't just plain. Sorry, but this is, I'm sure he noticed this. They weren't just that. They were women of a singular type. Now, I don't know how many of you have read Lucky Jim, but the unsympathetic girl in that is called Margaret Peel. Now, Monica was called Monica Beal. And in the first draft of Lucky Jim, Margaret Peel was called Monica Peel. So he's only changed one letter in her name. She wears these horrible dirndl skirts and these huge earrings, and but it's not just that. She's a great one for making you feel guilty. She's a not very significant person who behaves like a superstar. She's like the woman, she reminds me of Stephen Hawking's wife, first wife, who said on TV, she said, no camera crews come to interview Stephen. They don't seem to be very interested in me. And you're watching this thinking, well, why would they be? Stephen Hawking's great contribution to cosmology is that he worked out that black holes must emit radiation, and no one thought they did. And it's called Hawking radiation. But his wife, I'm sure, thought it should be called Mrs. Hawking radiation. So great egotists who were nonetheless unattractive. That was the sort of woman.
He reminds me of certain kinds of clergymen. You get women who minister to them. I mean, you could see that you want to wash his socks for him and things like that. Wasn't it that kind of
relationship? Well, I think these women would have been too proud to. And I mean, Maeve Brennan, who, you know, God bless her, is still alive and all that, still very much alive, as they say. She was the woman who tried to reclaim him for Christianity, because she was religious. And after he died, she wrote to my father saying, you would surely have no objection to me saying at the funeral that he was with the angels. And my father wrote back saying, well, you can say that if you like, because it's a phrase that means you're on the side of good, but you know, it'd be monstrous if you tried to claim him for Christianity. Mm. That was what she tried to do. And she's the woman who, there's a terrifying late poem called Love Again, which is a poem of sexual jealousy about Maeve having lunch with another man. And she was a virgin on principle, and it's not even clear that she ever slept, or she did give in once or twice. Every now and then she gave in to Larkin. The poem begins, "Love again, wanking at 3:30. Or was it 4:30? and the first printer rang up Anthony Thwaite, the editor, and said, there's a misprint in the first line, it should be waking at 3:30. Monica, who's a sort of Maeve, who's a walking misprint herself, said, claimed that she'd never heard the word wanking and didn't know what it meant. Ah, sure. Pull the other one, darling. So pious, self-important, plain, not just unattractive. And also, as the evidence of Monica reveals, he'd given up on them. You know, he hadn't tried to. He didn't have the energy to spare. It was all lack of energy.
Well, I think that poem ends, doesn't it, with him talking about violence a long way back, and
wrong rewards,
and he seems to locate it in his own family and the choice he made very early on to that his writing could not withstand commitment to anything else.
Is that what it means, that last bit? It's very gnomic, very obscure, that last bit.
I think it is hinting at something in his childhood. It's hinting at something in his childhood that went wrong. But I do think that this is a problem with Larkin, that for all his genius at describing the familiar, and the familiar not an exotic landscape, but the landscape everyone has been through without sort of giving it a further thought. For all his concentration on everyday experience, nevertheless, you have to watch out with him. He's very, very tricky. He's very tricksy. And complaining about your never having had, essentially sort of coming on as if you'd never had sex, famously saying it all began too late for you in 1963. I mean, this act is a mask for something, for saying something else. What you're implying is, yes, I had sex, but I didn't enjoy it very much. Or, you know, it was not with sort of tremendously attractive people. But clearly, he had a genius at getting the undivided attention of numerous women.
A certain sort of women.
So it's not quite leveling with the reader. And the poem that ends, "Nothing Like Something Happens Anywhere," the poem about Coventry, is a very good example of that, that he talks about things he's refusing to describe his childhood in terms of the kind of cliches that he gets from other people's descriptions of their childhood. And he implies, therefore, that sort of nothing at all happened in his childhood. And yet it's or in his youth. And yet very striking things happened, which happened to him and his generation and not to us, i.e. That Coventry was flattened and that he grew up in a house with a father who supported Adolf Hitler.
And took Larkin to two Nuremberg rallies.
There was a lot of not, you know, these things that didn't happen turn out to be actually rather fascinating. Coming on as if it's an aesthetic stance to say other people are sort of gussying up their experience, making it sound more interesting than it was. And that's true of a lot of bad writing. But it's not an answer to pretend that that nothing happened. Do you see what I mean?
His childhood, he claims, was a forgotten boredom. Despite having the father who had a figurine of a fascist, the little mannequin on the mantelpiece that when you pressed a button did a Heil Hitler salute, and those trips to, I don't think he ever went. He went to Germany to collect a prize, and he went to Paris once, but those trips to Germany put him off travel for good. Yeah. And he said, Miriam Gross said in a famous interview, she said, well, would you like to go to China? He said, I wouldn't mind going to China if I could come back the same day. I mean, again, slightly posing,
the other story of his traveling is when he went for the job interview at Reading University for the librarianship there, and he turned up at the interview in Reading, arrived at the door to do the interview, and immediately left without doing the interview to take the train back to Hull, because he couldn't face the prospect of leaving his little zone of isolation. So it wasn't just travel outside of England, it was leaving that little protective zone he'd built around himself in Hull.
But by the way, it's aesthetic and it's not professional. If you read him writing about things to do with librarianship, it's absolutely, he's absolutely straightforward. And he wouldn't have succeeded as a modern librarian unless he'd taken all things to do with librarianship, professional life, absolutely seriously.
There's 200 people under him and you know, big administrative job. And he was rather ashamed of being so competent at that.
So this is a very peculiar thing, but it's not quite the same as honesty, is it? It may produce these blinding effects that remind us of our most poignant experience, like the experience of going to a hospital, for instance. He probably described that in poetry, perhaps in English poetry for the first time. I don't know. Yeah. I would think so. It's a very good subject. It's one that we're all liable to share. An experience we're all liable to share. And that's. Larkin has sort of put his signature on it, but perhaps it's essentially in talking about himself that he's playing these tricks all the time.
He none of the usual things as an adult happened to him. I mean, no marriage, no children, no war, no divorce. You know, these very common experiences of his generation. He excluded himself from all that. We've talked about the rocky period he went through, and it might be, you know, sanitary to recall just how violent the rejection of Larkin was in the early 90s when the letters and the life came out. It was perhaps at the height of the political correct, relativist moment. And there were some things in the letters, particularly, that looked tremendously ugly to us. To quote the worst of them, he's talking about a cricket match. He said, as for that black scum, it's the West Indies, that black scum on the boundary, he said, a squadron of South African police would have sorted them out to my satisfaction, Where, I mean, there's absolutely nothing in the life of active racism of any kind, but that's a very nasty sentiment with a sort of proxy violence that one remove in it. And he says some terrible things about women. But what the commentariat, rather than the reading public, was unable to do in the early 90s was separate the poetry, which is all that matters, from these, what Larkin called growls of rage, that he writes, he's got one particularly right-wing friend who lives in a trailer, eccentric ex-army guy. And he pours out all his vitriol. He says it's just a way of saying grr. But in an ideological climate, people were unable to separate that. And it's quite a tribute to his verse that the public, he did slump very much, immeasurably, but then he came back, and we should perhaps talk about what is it about Larkin that is so unusual. And we'd have to begin by saying that the humor and the memorability. It's almost as if, I don't know that there is another poet as memorable as Larkin, how effortlessly memorable. You only have to read him a couple of times, and how funny. When he's talking about why he never got married, and the poem's called Self's the Man, begins, no one can deny that Arnold is less selfish than I. He married her to stop her getting away. Now she's there all day. And the money, and the money he gets for wasting his life on work, she takes as her perk for the kiddies' clobber and the dryer and the electric fire. And it's marvelously self-contradictory because, the electric fire is something he's benefiting from as well. I mean, but the humor and the rhythm, and it ends, but I'm a better hand at knowing what I can stand without them sending a van, or I think I can. So he knew that his peculiarity risked a kind of mental instability. But this memorability is, where does that come from? That is a sort of distillation of talent and...
Yeah, I think the letters, Martin, as well, even though they may have caused a slump, they're also, and we spoke with this before, James, they're incredibly entertaining a lot of the time, especially in the first two-thirds of the book, when he's much happier, and he's very interesting writing about writers. And it's one of the things, I suppose, the caricature of Larkin as a Philistine is belied by the letters, which are full of talk about not just jazz, but Elgar and Handel, and not just Hardy, but D.H. Lawrence and Yeats as well.
Very honest and very candid.
But standing for a kind of narrowing of the vision. You don't go to Larkin to see, to find out what some adventurous reader has been discovering in, say, European fiction or something like that. You don't. That's not Larkin.
But
and also there is this sense that, which I think he shared with your, it was a sort of act that he developed with your father, that it was essentially, what was good in poetry was coming, had come to an end, and that it was sort of curtains now, It's like the attitude to jazz in his jazz writing. I don't know enough about jazz to know how good the actual jazz writing is about the things that he likes, but you can see that what he's saying is that when New Orleans jazz of the period that he adores, when that kind of comes to an end and there's a new period, then everything is finished for him. And so the attitude that Picasso, Pound, and Charlie Parker screwed everything up.
And he says more specifically, he says that jazz ended when, and he puts it this way, he said, when the black man stopped trying to entertain the white man. And then once the music became intellectualized and people like Coleman Hawkins would be going to French academies and be lauded by the academy and become...
Going to the Juilliard School.
Yes, become highbrow. He was, the plain man taken to perhaps where the mask rots the face, in that he took it too far and became the mask. We should perhaps also talk about briefly about the fear of death, because this is the other great theme. Transience is an eternal theme, and so, by the way, is the idea that the good is gone, that the golden age has passed. I think one of the very earliest examples of human writing written in shit on the wall of some ancient cave says, children no longer respect their parents. it's sort of primordial. but the fear of death is there and is there in the letters as well. And it's something he shared with my father. I think most people, don't really. Freud says you don't. It's the death of a pet when you're a child, and then the death of a grandparent, usually when you're in that age, when you're 12, 13, that when death starts to become real. It isn't real until then. But I don't think we take on the meaning of our own death until we're about 45. And in fact, you could define youth as that ridiculous feeling where you sort of look in the mirror and you think, I accept that I'm going to die, because everyone seems to, and everyone always has, but clever you, you seem to have found a way around it. That's youth, and when that goes, death comes. Death is, mortality is something that, again, takes years to really sink in. But I think Larkin had it in his teenage years. And so did my father, and so have others. Julian Barnes's book, Nothing to be Frightened Of, records this early onset of death awareness. And there's no question that, Obad, the famous poem of waking early and saying, that this is a fear that nothing dispels. Religion used to try that vast moth-eaten musical brocade created to pretend we never die, and all that. But then you look at the last letter in the volume, written, and he died very young. What was he, 63? And it's a letter to my father, and it mentions my sister, my mother, and it's dictated. It goes on for quite, it's a couple of thousand words. And he discharging, doing a favor for Kingsley about some poet character in one of his novels, and thanking my sister for writing to him independently. And then he says at the end, imagine me then, packing up my shaving things and my bathroom things and packing my bag and heading off to the hospital for the big one. And he says, I have a feeling I don't deserve this year. I haven't deserved this year. It's all come at once and not spread out as it is with most people. And then he says, forgive the absence of the usual salutation, because a secretary was going to type this out, because they always ended with a joke with the word bum in it, every letter they ever exchanged. He forgive the absence of that. And then off he goes, and he died that weekend. And tremendously stoic and calm, and you know, death was very close. You know, the turns out to be a courage in his verse that allowed him to write about death so head on, square on.
I think that may be one of the things that turned him off writing novels, perhaps, is it his poems, when they describe these characters or their scenes, they rush very quickly to their vanishing point at the end. That's the great movement of a lot of Larkin's poems, I think. That's something that he felt he could do in poems. And as you say, from a very young age, you know, the early poems are full of this dreadful mortality as well, I think. James, I know you've written a little bit about the extremity of Larkin's writing about death as well. Is there anything, for any particular poems that you can think where?
About his writing about death. Sorry, I'm a bit
lost. Obad, I suppose, is the most famous of the poems, not published in a book in his own lifetime.
Yes, well, there was a group of poems that came out in the it was in the TLS, wasn't it?
Yeah.
He suddenly produced this. There were just sort of three poems or so.
I was actually The Old Fools and The Building.
And Obad.
Yeah.
I was actually thinking just then, in connection with this thing about death, that Auden had a sort of yearning for death, which was also surprising because it came on him at a surprisingly early age, really. I mean, he was physically decaying, but he was. It's not entirely clear to me why that was. I think it was perhaps a life of drugs. It was uppers and downers that he'd, you know, taken in common with a lot of people in his generation. That he'd taken Benzedrine from an early age in order to work. And then coming down in the evening with some cocktails and so on. Anyway, and he entered a kind of depression towards the end of his life in which he actually really wanted to go. And he went as a comparatively young man. This was in 75, and I'm now trying to think exactly what his birth date. Well, we know what his birth date was.
His centenary was last year, so 1907 yes. to 75, 68.
Yeah, he was 68, and he had seemed like a very old man, perhaps from his 60th, perhaps from around his 60th year. Larkin, yes, it came on him, it must have come on him very, very suddenly, but it had been there as a subject for him, and something he addressed.
Very good. Righto. Thanks, James and Martin. I'd like to open up questions from the floor now, so I'd like to call on our two roving mics to step up. And if anybody has any questions, if you could raise your hand nice and high. And there's a question there in the middle, Simon, I think, in the row there. And then you, and then we'll go that side.
Hi. You mentioned Larkin's preoccupation with death, which is clear from his work. But also, surely he's responsible for writing some of the most life-affirming poems that have been written in the English language, poems like The Trees, for example.
Yes,
yeah. And I wonder if he'd be able to do that, were he not quite so preoccupied with the other end of the stick, as it were.
It's a very striking poem, Trees.
Very.
With that line about their greenness as a kind of grief. I think that is quintessentially Larkin, because only Larkin would have looked at a tree coming into leaf in spring and associated it with grief.
But he also goes on to say, doesn't he, last year is dead, they seem to say, begin afresh,
yes,
afresh, afresh. So we have the affirmation.
Wonderful onomatopoeia.
Indeed.
No, I mean, you know he wrote at the end of that, on the typescript or the manuscript, bloody awful sentimental balls or something. But it's a companion poem to, it's almost near identical technically to They Fuck You Up, Your Mum and Dad.
Yes.
It's the other side of that coin. You know?
Certainly. But I think it certainly proves that he's more than one-dimensional, insofar as he's not entirely gloomy. More than one-dimensional, he's not entirely gloomy. He is exploring both ends of the spectrum rather than just one.
Indeed, I think there's a, I mean, it wouldn't work at all unless there was this undertow of a kind of yearning affirmation that he knew. I mean, an Arundel tomb, which ends, are half instinct, half almost true. What will survive of us is love, and you see the tomb, that the sharp intake of breath as he notices that these two statues are holding hands, these symbolic figures on the tombstone. And then he wrote underneath that, he wrote, just because they've been holding hands for 500 years doesn't mean they're not dead. he'd write the poem and then have the cynical thought, you know, always.
But those competing instincts are, I think you're right,
you're
what
right,
make
yeah.
the poems work. It would be useless if he was writing, death is coming for us all, and that was it, in every one of the poems, you know, death is coming for what, and he does describe what's going to disappear. That's what makes the poems.
If he's a poet of anything, he's a poet of uncertainty, because he's always adding qualifications, just at the end of the Arundel tomb, almost instinct, almost true, or... more famously, I don't know, which seems to come up again and again and again. This big uncertainty is there in his writing. But I think that's what makes him particularly brave, that he's prepared to say that he's not certain.
Yes. Thank you. Simon, can we take... There's two here at the front, and then we'll go back to the back. So. Yeah, let's go. Let's come to the mic coming your way. Right, the man in the second row first, there.
Thank you. May I first say that I too was a librarian in Hull from 1965 until 1972. I know Larkin on his 9-to-5 job. Forgetting that, 25 years later, I went to Hull University to read English Lit. I found I was jaundiced when I came to trying to read Larkin and appreciate him. I don't know whether because of the 9-to-5, you know, business I knew of him, because he was one of those people, if you'd been to a meeting with him, you hoped he wouldn't ask you to go out for a drink afterwards. Unfortunately, he was one of those people who didn't create friendships where you could sort of talk after it. It was many, many years later when I read Alan Bennett read some Larkin out on television that I suddenly realised what Larkin was trying to say to me. I missed something along the way. There's the odd thing, like his piece about a first arrival in Hull on the train going along the Humber Estuary.
Yeah.
I went to Hull the same way. I could appreciate that, but most of it I just felt, and I think personally, just the fact that you get to know somebody in a 9-to-5 slot, you know, can you then, or is it possible then to put on a...
Well, it's interesting you use the phrase 9-to-5 man, because this is Seamus Heaney's phrase for Larkin, the way that he tries to cultivate the sense of being a 9-to-5 man in his poems, but a 9-to-5 man who has seen poetry. And who wants to do more than just render the ordinary detail of the world, I think. But he was a separate life as a poet from his life as a librarian, I think, as James.
Well, I think there is a kind of embarrassment about being a poet and about the act of writing poetry itself. The kind of disclaimers that Martin was quoting are one aspect of that. Another aspect of it is he'll start a poem in a very ugly way, and he's going to end it in a very beautiful way. The High Windows is like that. But it's as if he's got to say to you, it would be sentimental to write a poem that was just beautiful all the way through. I know that's not allowed. So here's a really ugly thought, unpleasantly expressed, and then suddenly he gives you something that's beautiful. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I see what you mean. I can appreciate you. I think he's a brilliant writer, but I just cannot. Oh, I can do now vaguely as I'm getting older. But in the period when I should have been able to, when I say 25 years after I worked with him, I went to university as a mature student and read English Lit. I found I just could not. And being whole university, we did Larkin, obviously. I just couldn't get on the same wavelength. And I just wondered whether this was something that would, is because of my, as I say, what I call the 9-to-5 knowledge.
Right. But it's on his side, it's as far as poetry is concerned, it's because he's ill at ease with it, or he becomes ill at ease with it. When he was writing The North Ship, he was much more ready to be the bard, because he was borne up by the example of Yeats. Mm-hmm. Yeats's rhetoric, and still there was some of Auden's rhetoric in there. But when he got rid of that, he was sort of a bit embarrassed. It reminds me of very different example, but there's a similar psychology. Richard Burton, who didn't really like being an actor, he didn't think that was sort of a very manly thing to be. And when it got to the stage where he could stipulate whatever he was going to do, they would still have him in the film. He was in some historical film, and he made a stipulation that he would only wear the costume. So it was a sort of Elizabethan costume. He'd only wear the costume from the waist up, and he'd wear his own trousers. And so they filmed him entirely in close-up because he sort of wasn't going to put on those tights and, you know. It's a bit like that with Larkin, that, you know, he's not going to wear the whole.
Good. Sam, there's somebody here, and then JT, there's someone in the middle aisle as well.
This is a question for you, Martin. I was very interested to hear about Monica's mannerisms that you picked up when you had the dinner in 1981. I saw her a lot later than that, when she was pretty well near death. And the mannerism that I remember particularly was not this sort of thing that you got, but a rocking to and fro and sideways when she disagreed with you. Did you ever come across that?
No, she...
But like this, rocking this way, and then this way, and this way.
No, she was doing that already.
She was doing that. Well, the real question I wanted to ask you, I heard you were you're writing a fictional account of her. Is that correct?
Yes, I sort of tried and failed to do that, but I'm coming back to it in a different mode. But I'm trying to get Monica on paper.
Can you tell us a bit more about that? You know, is it your next novel?
Next but one. But I mean, it's very weird. You know, I happen to know a couple of quite intimate things about this. In that, when my father called this horrible girl in Lucky Jim Margaret
Peel.
In the first draft, Monaco.
That's right, yeah.
Peel. He said, he quite hurt Larkin, said, no, you can't possibly do that. And he said, what can I, Margaret Peel, at least, you know. And now this is an incredible fact. He gives up writing fiction for this reason. This is the reason he gives. He said, the third novel, he'd written two in his early 20s, the third novel should be an attack on Monica, he said. His third novel. You know, and what else is there to write about? You know, that Monica looms so large as a figure of oppression and probably hatred at a certain level, that he thought, well, I'll give up being a novelist since my natural subject is an attack on Monica. So, you know, one moves from that to feelings that it was emotional sadomasochism in some way. Because, you know, why do you stay with someone who made you give up fiction because you couldn't attack her?
Monica had her vengeance as well in some respects, because yeah. Larkin left his entire estate of £1 million, the notoriously mean Larkin, to Monica, who on her death left it to Durham Cathedral. This Larkin, the atheist, would hardly have...
She left it to Durham Cathedral?
She left it to two cathedrals, actually. The majority of it to Durham Cathedral, and the other two, another cathedral in the north, Hexham Abbey, that's
what,
right.
What a great choice of cathedrals and abbeys to leave it to. I feel that Monica's had a rough time this evening. And we ought to celebrate.
I think there's somebody here in the middle aisle. Is there? With a hand raised.
You said, can you hear me?
Yes.
You said at the beginning, John, about Larkin's popularity within the UK, and I wonder whether the panel might like to comment on how his reputation has fared in Europe and in the States.
Can I say something very briefly about this, picking up what James said? One of the things I think that led to the rise of Larkin's reputation in the 70s, or after the 70s perhaps, is that Robert Lowell and Elizabeth Bishop were, I think, very important poets for a lot of English and Irish writers who thought of Larkin as being the great English poet of his generation. And I think Larkin has been a poet's poet in the US for quite a long time. I think Lowell writes to Bishop about Larkin in the early 60s, I think.
Yes. Lowell certainly recognized Larkin on the basis of, I would think, of The Less Deceived. I mean,
yeah,
but if not The Less Deceived, then at least The Wits and Weddings. No, I think on the basis of The Less Deceived. He must have been pointed in that direction by somebody. I don't know who that would have been, unless it was Eliot.
Mm. Eliot, who said of Larkin, he seems to be able to make words do exactly as he wants. that favoured as well. Mm.
Well, yeah, what a compliment coming from Eliot. Mm. So I think in the States, he's not been short of recognition. In Europe, I'm afraid I simply don't know. But
well, that's problematic, isn't it? Because was it Paul Valéry who defined poetry itself as that which gets lost in translation? And it wouldn't just be a verbal loss, but the sort of the Englishness of Larkin would be very hard to transfer. And I think within Europe, within different languages, it's a poet is well known for other reasons, for a sort of political placement or some other, or very much proclaiming some political viewpoint. It's hard to measure. But I think it's true, isn't it, that in America his reputation is growing, is big, is large and growing.
I think that a similar thing happened in the States to people's reading lists, that in the States Robert Frost became more and more valued. You know, that Jarrell was keen on Frost from an early stage, but to build up a reputation where he's considered, you know, a fundamental American classic, and is a bit similar to what was happening to Hardy's reputation in Britain. And of course, Larkin had a role, and still has a role in that process. And if you think of the way the reading list has changed, then actually the kind of people I was talking about early on, some of them, a question mark hangs over them. For instance, Pound. How many people read Pound today? How many people think that the essence of serious reading is to read the cantos, and that this is the supreme achievement of modernism? I don't know the answer to this question, but I doubt it's as large a number of people as it used to be. There's a sort of question mark over Pound. It's not a question mark over Frost. Now, in the 1960s, that would have been the situation would have been somewhat reversed, I would have thought. Isn't that so?
I think that's right, yeah. It's just a follow-up question on that, is about how English writers feel about Larkin as being a representative poet of England, because I do think that in the US he is seen as a poet of England, whereas I think in England he's still a lyrical poet, and he's a lyric poet maybe as much, but the picture of England that comes across in Larkin's poems is quite a, for maybe an American readership, quite a comfortable picture of decline and isolation and being cut off.
It's seductive in its way, and it's you know, one can't live by Larkin's philosophy, can one?
No.
This is we may as well give up if we were to do that.
But and also self-suppression.
I mean,
it's not, you know, as he asks in The Old Fools, why aren't they screaming? You know, if you feel like that, why aren't you screaming? Because of Englishness, because that's, you don't do that. You know? And I think he dramatizes that very beautifully, but it is a kind of comfortable view of England if you're an American, yeah, for instance.
Let me think, there's another thing as well, that if people are reading poets from that, what has now become a period, three stand out. That's Larkin, Tom Gunn, and Ted Hughes. And I'm very much taken with Tom Gunn's later poetry, particularly his love poetry. I think is absolutely marvelous. And I find him the most, in a way, the most congenial of the three. Even his faults, I find congenial, if you know what I mean. Ted Hughes the least, despite some of his, you know, the early poems and the wonderful things that can crop up all along the way. I suppose for me, Hughes is the one that I have to sort of blank out in my mind. It was certainly so when I was growing up, that his was a kind of aesthetic that was in danger of predominating. Really, Larkin sort of won the race. like the tortoise. Like, I mean, it was a sort of tortoise-like victory.
You would say, you could say that Tom Gunn was the cerebral one, so it seemed, certainly when he began, carnal knowledge.
Yes.
And Ted Hughes was the animalistic, instinctivist one. It was all about animals and
blood and guts.
Violence. He was red in tooth and claw. And it was Larkin who was, the more diffident and the more ironic that actually was more in tune with the times, perhaps. But
it's an interesting point, actually, that both Ted Hughes and Tom Gunn have had excellent selected poems over the years, but there's no actual selected Larkin available at the moment. You're left with these two varyingly unusable collected poems, one which collects just the books, which you have there, James, and the other collected, which includes everything in a sort of a random or date order, which is a hard book to negotiate as well, I think.
Yes, it is.
We'll take one more question. So if there's any, right at the very, very back, if we can.
Well, by the way, while the microphone's going down, I'd say the best way to read Larkin is through his three individual collections. You can do that, and you'll get most of it.
You'll miss the late poems, though, won't you? You'll miss Obad and Love Again and these terrific...
It's true. You could get them photocopied for you.
Okay.
With your mentions of Ted Hughes, I was just interested thinking about something a lecturer of mine told me he was working on, which was based on Hughes's comments that Larkin had plagiarized some pieces of work. Now, this was probably really in many ways sour grapes based on what Larkin said about Hughes in a lot of his letters and diaries and so on, which of course was quite vicious. But is there any suggestion that maybe Larkin perhaps did plagiarize, or is that ultimately Hughes himself?
I don't think there is any suggestion of that, but one of the great letters in the Ted Hughes collected letters is when Larkin is dying, and Hughes, they had a natural antipathy to one another, I think, and never got on, but Hughes wrote to Larkin suggesting a faith healer he knew. And it's a very long, involved letter in which he lists all the cases in which the faith healer had worked for people that Hughes knew, and he encourages Larkin even to ring him in this last week, as it turned out, because he had known that it could work over the phone. So there is a, which is, depending on where you're coming from, laughable, but at the same time, there's a sort of a fellow feeling. They're opposed in style, but there is some fellow feeling, I think, between them as poets of that generation.
Yeah, well, if it comes down to faith healing, it's a fellow feeling that I happily do without.
and one of, that's a good way to end it, Larkin's self-descriptions in his letters, where he says, he said, I'm so fat that when I sit down, my tongue comes out. But he said, there's a photograph of me, he's talking about the American edition of it, I think it's The Wits and Weddings, where he says, with a truly terrible photograph of me on the back that cries out for the caption, faith healer or heartless fraud?
Okay, I'd like to ask you to thank James and Martin for tonight's performance. Can I ask you all to remain in your seats for 2 minutes, please? James and Martin will be signing books downstairs at the Blackwell's bookstall. So please wait until they make it down to the bookstall. And also do take your fabulous Manchester Review bag home with you, along with all the information about our forthcoming readings, which you can still book tickets for. And also there should be information there about the Manchester Literature Festival, which is starting in 10 days or so. So I hope we'll see you all at future events here at the Centre for New Writing. Thank you.